Hello, and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast and impatient world. I'm Carl Honnery, your host, and my guest today is Rob Orchard, journalist, director, and founder of the Slow Journalism Company, and editor of a magazine whose title always brings a smile to my lips. It's called The Delayed Gratification Quarterly. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thank you very much, Carl. Very nice to be here.
Well, as a journalist myself, of course, this is a subject very close to my heart. I cover all things slow, but at core, I remain a journalist, especially a print journalist. So I'm thrilled to be able to sit down and chat with you about what you've been doing. Let's start by talking about the title, because I know that when people create new magazines, a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of sweat and blood and tears goes into coming up with the title. How did you end up with Delayed Gratification?
I think we ended up with Delayed Gratification only by the narrowest of narrow margins. So we had all sorts of other things in contention. And there was a very strong contingent of the people who were setting the magazine up who thought it was a dreadful name, and a few of us who thought it was great. And eventually we sort of won through. But nobody was totally sure about it for the first few issues until it settled into itself. It is still the case, definitely, that a certain number of people who hear the title of the magazine think it is some sort of compendium of erotica. Mm-hmm. And I'm never sure whether that's helpful or harmful, you know, to our cause. Right. And I have had a few people say to me that they feel a little bit embarrassed sometimes walking around in public with it, you know, because it sounds, you know, it sounds vaguely sexual, delayed gratification. However, I'm not sure how much credence to give that, because there's always a beautiful piece of artwork on the cover and it's never erotic. Mm-hmm. So the name obviously refers to the additional pleasure and gratification that you can receive if you take your time.
Let's unpack this term, slow journalism.
Yes.
It has a wonderful ring to it. What does it mean to you and your team?
So for us, primarily, it's about providing some sort of counterpoint to increase the increased speed of the digital news agenda. So what we get at the moment is this extraordinary white noise of news. You wake up every morning, there's 300 or 400 new news stories coming at you. They're coming at you through your favorite news sites. They're coming at you through Facebook and through Twitter. They're coming through on your smartphone, on your laptop. If you wanted to, you could very easily spend every moment of every day trying to keep on top of the news, on top of the live blogs from, you know, 10 different cities around the world, and the constant, you know, rolling news updates from the 24/7 TV news, and still not feel properly on top of it. So our thought was to do something that was the opposite of that. So what we do is once every 3 months, we produce a beautiful print magazine which draws a line in the sand. It looks back over the events of that quarter and it says, or it asks the question of what was genuinely important. You know, when you get rid of the journalism and the PR fluff and the storms in a teacup and the Twitter spats and, you know, the stories that turned into kind of nothing, what are you left with? We revisit those stories after the dust has settled. So after everybody else has moved on, after the media agenda has moved on to other stories, you know, we go back to them. And we try to tell the end of the stories. We try to tell how they've moved on rather than giving the first knee-jerk reaction. Mm. So this is our idea, is to provide sort of a counterpoint and at some level an antidote to the super speed of you know, mainstream news production.
Do you have 3 points that slow journalism delivers? I guess, what are the sort of keywords that you would throw around in a marketing meeting, I suppose?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Perspective is number one. So actually, it's very, very difficult for a lot of journalists these days, because what they're asked to do is tell stories when they are only just hearing about them themselves. You know, we've sped up to such a degree that actually journalists are being faced with the problem of having to tell you about stuff that's happening right now. So, you know, we cut to our reporter on the scene and, you know, they're telling you about stuff that's happening directly over their shoulder. No time for comment, no time for analysis, no time for talking to experts and trying to gauge, you know, what's going on. No time for that first best approximation of the truth, just relaying exactly what's happening. And many times, in many cases, they're also on the back foot. So they're trying to break stories or trying to report stories that have already, you know, started to be told on social media. So there's this constant pressure from things like Twitter for journalists to try to kind of keep up with that. And it's, it can be very, very difficult for them indeed. So I think number one thing that we're championing is perspective. Is saying, you know, actually, journalists are worth something, and, you know, should be, there should be a forum in which they can play to their strengths, taking their time and kind of, you know, revisiting stories. I think the second thing that sort of follows on from that is investment in journalism, prioritizing of journalism. And that means instead of giving journalists, you know, a one-hour deadline to cobble something together with a few miscellaneous quotes and bang it out and get it up online, it's giving them 3 months. 3 months to really pick a story apart, to take their time, you know, to go back to the scene, to revisit it, to speak with people, and to bring a really kind of, you know, nourishing, important story out of it. We are a tiny organization, so, you know, we don't have, you know, huge budgets that we can throw at stuff. That said, we've always prioritized paying journalists, increasing the amount we pay journalists as much as possible, and really investing in stories as much as we can. And that's something we're really committed to, you know, over the coming years. So I guess there's the perspective element, there's the investment element, and then there's also just this thing of creating something of value. So, you know, in the slow food and slow travel movements, there's a huge amount about, you know, when you take your time, you produce something of more quality. So, you know, slow food instead of the hamburger kind of grabbed and wolfed down in 30 seconds. It's the slow cook thing that took, you know, 2 days, and is just wonderful because you put that much care and attention into it. So I think part of what we're doing is that as well, is just saying, you know, you make this artifact once every 3 months. We've often described ourselves as somewhere between being a really slow magazine and a really fast history book. You know, it's kind of a first pass at writing a history book, and you build these magazines up and they become almost a sort of a contemporary history of the world. So there's this idea of creating something beautiful that people will want to treasure, something that's not throwaway, something that's not ephemeral. And that feeds through into beautiful production values, you know, fantastic print quality, lovely paper. But it's also, you know, that investment in wonderful infographics that will make you laugh and inspire you. It's in seeking down brilliant photo features and photojournalists who can tell a story over kind of 10 pages and really, really draw you in. It's that long form feature that leaves you buzzing afterwards. So I guess that's our third watchword, is trying to create something of permanence and value that people will treasure and collect.
The rise of slow journalism, it seems to me, is part of a bigger tectonic shift going on, isn't it? This feeling of overwhelmness, that things are coming at us at a rate of knot, a barrage, and you use that phrase, people feel they struggle to keep on top of things. And we've always had that expression, haven't we, news junkie.
Yeah,
you know, that feeling of, and that it's harder now, is it not, to be a news junkie than ever before, because there's a fix on every corner, there's a fix on every phone screen. It's consuming itself in a sense. It's like we can't really go any further down that road. Is that,
well, we say that, but then
can we?
I was fascinated to see about, you know, the launch of the Apple Watch, and the fact that news organizations are now trying to, you know, trying to work out how you give somebody something of value that fits on, you know, a watch screen. And obviously that's going to be something that then kind of drags you off to something else. But so that sort of thing's happening. I don't know whether Google Glass is actually genuinely going to take off, but you could see us going down the route where actually you were having, you know, news headlines and updates constantly basically broadcast onto your eyeballs. So I don't know about that. Yes, I think there is a real worry with things being, you know, being overwhelming. And I'm as much of a sort of a news junkie and a smartphone junkie as anybody else. I have to confess that. And it's the smallest unit of pleasure that you can get, isn't it? Is, you know, like dragging your thumb down and some sort of update popping up. Whether it's a new news story or somebody who's kind of, you know, done
you get
tweet.
A little dopamine squirt.
It's a little squirt of dopamine. It's, you know, it's that, you know, rat in a trap thing. Banging away on the button and you get a little pellet. That's effectively what's happening all day. And I don't see any way to get around that because it's so geared up to you know, how human addiction works. I mean, I am absolutely addicted to my smartphone. And when I try to sort of, you know, be away from it for a few hours or turn it off or get away, I get antsy, you know, I get itchy, and I hate that about myself, particularly given that I'm, you know, running this company, which
is dedicated to the company.
Exactly. But of course, you know, it is. It's absolutely addictive. And when you genuinely step back, when you look at the news stories in a day, when you do some proper analysis on it, very few of them are actually news, as in we've investigated something and we found out this, you know, this revelatory piece of content. Most of it is a mishmash of things that have gone before. It's conjecture, it's reporting of speculation and counter-speculation. There's actually a huge amount of commercial stuff, you know, that has snuck its way in, you know, bogus PR surveys that are being reported and then, you know, reported on the reporting and so on. If you really strip it down out of those 300 or 400 news stories every day, you know, maybe 5% of them are genuinely conveying something important, something new, something, you know, like a volcano has erupted and people are at risk, or, or you know, a ship has capsized and migrants have died. The rest is just flim-flam nonsense.
It's just white noise.
It's just white noise. And, of course, there's no such thing as, you know, an objective measure of what the news is or should be. There's no place you can be that is like News Central where you can check with the mayor of news what is and isn't news.
Unless you're in North Korea.
Unless you're in North Korea, exactly, in which case that absolutely is. But no, it's just, you know, there's no reason that news has to be a 24/7 thing. There's no reason that, you know, there have to be these 400 stories. You could equally as well, you know, you could imagine this state in which you wake up and somebody's genuinely worked out the three things you really need to know that day. And that almost used to be how it was, because you'd wake up in the morning, you'd take your train into work, and you'd read your paper on the way into work. Then you'd feel caught up for the day. And if you were, you know, really into your news, you might also watch the news at 10 at the end of the day. And then that would be it. That would, you know, that's plenty. That's, you're effectively a news junkie because of that. And now, as I said, you know, I mean, it'd be, you know, if you were genuinely trying to keep on top of things, it'd be very difficult to hold down your job because it's just incessant. Even on a day when there's genuinely, you know, nothing has happened. Mm. You know, you're just watching people speculate about when, you know, the royal child might arrive, you know, and what it might be called. But still, you know, you're there. You know, you're also, not just you're there, but you're also being sucked in. They're trying to canvass your opinion about it. Like, what do you think it should be called? How would it be, you know, if it was called this or that or the other? You know, follow us on Twitter. Tell us with your hashtag and so on. I mean, it's just the amount of time that's wasted, the amount of time that's sucked out of people's lives by nonsensical news is vast.
Mm-hmm. In a way, that notion of the medium shaping the news and how we experience it, it's always been there, hasn't it? Mm. Because if you look at, I felt this when I moved to Britain from Canada and suddenly found myself looking at tabloid newspapers. Mm. And even The Independent, when it went tabloid, suddenly one single story is the whole front page. Mm. And that in and of itself elevates that item of news, that nugget of information, to something bigger than if it's just one. Yeah. And we've now gone completely to the end of that spectrum where we've got this infinite space on the web that it has to be fueled, the furnace has to be stocked with coal endlessly. So you do find yourself in this kind of carousel of distraction and vacuity, it seems like, in a way.
Yes.
And you talked about 5% of that stuff being actually of real merit and importance. But that means there's 95% out there in the ether that's really just either toxic or pointless or both.
Well, the internet has just blown this industry to pieces, you know, the journalism industry, the news industry. And in some ways, it's extraordinary because actually, you know, a newspaper that before could only ever expect to sell in the UK, and, you know, it would reach the, you know, the boundaries of its natural, you know, market share and so on relatively quickly. You know, now it could reach, theoretically, every single person on the planet, you know, instantly and immediately. That's an amazing thing. But it does all feed into this, you know, and given that, you know, given that print advertising revenues have been coming down, given that print subscriptions and newsstand sales have been coming down, you know, there's this huge new importance with online advertising. And, of course, the only way that you can get that is by sheer numbers, and the numbers these days have to be absolutely gigantic. So there's this, you know, this very skewed economic set of incentives that we, you know, we have now given the news industry, which is, you know, as you say, to get as much out as possible, because that's going to help with your rankings, to make it, you know, as controversial as possible, because that's going to help with your visibility and so on, to do it as often as possible, because, you know, and as swiftly as possible, because that's going to mean you get more links and, you know, you rise further up the rankings and so on. And, you know, the goal, the dream is that you could reach, you know, colossal numbers of people, and that would feed through to, you know, amazing advertising, and then, you know, it would all work. But that's not, you know, that's not the only thing that happens. It also means that you get this degrading of news, you get this degrading of journalism, and, you know, you get journalists being forced into ridiculous turnaround times just so they can keep up with Twitter, which I think is quite unhealthy, and it's all terribly new. I mean, because we adapt so fast as humans, it now feels normal, but it's not normal. You know, it wasn't like this 10 years ago, and it definitely wasn't like this 20 years ago. And if you talk to, as I'm sure you do, when you talk to news journalists, kind of a lot of the big titles, they just feel under siege. They just say, my editor came in and he said, this person has died and I need to do a profile on them and it needs to be up in an hour. You know, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do? Is scan Wikipedia, bang together a few plausible phrases and ask yourself, why was it I went to university for this? What was the point?
you talk about economic forces driving that, but there's, I think, maybe also a cultural imperative too, isn't there? That when it comes to technology, we often fall into this notion that because we can, we should. Mm. So simply because we can put a watch on our wrist that delivers status updates from Instagram and Facebook, we should do it, that it would be good for us. Without ever really asking, seems to me, the question, does this make us happier, healthier, more productive, more creative? Does it help us find our better angels?
Yeah.
We just pile on in and do it.
Yes.
And in a way, I sort of feel like as a journalist myself, having started in the 1990s and been writing at a time when you didn't have someone coming in and saying, I need a profile in 45 minutes, and you had time to craft, to think, to reflect, to look at the bigger picture, to make something of real, using your perspective, value, all that stuff, and to see that track through with my own friends who've stayed in media and so on, and how disheartened they feel by it all.
But do you know what? I don't think that the genie is ever going back in the bottle, because I mean, there's never really been a case of that. And to chug in another metaphor, the pendulum always swings back a little bit, and I think we've seen that, over the last 5 years. And I think that, there is this interest as well in having something that is, a counterpoint and a counterbalance to the way the mainstream, news comes to us. But I don't think we're ever going backwards. I think it will only ever get sort of faster and faster and more frenetic. And also something that I think is really interesting is more personalized. So, one of the kind of the great movements, it seems to me, for sort of the next wave of digitization is making everything super personalized. So, of course, in the future, you will have a newsfeed that is almost entirely kind of exclusively tailored to you, I think.
Do you think that's a good thing?
I think in some ways it can be positive, but I think the problem is...
Who's doing the curating, I suppose, when it comes to the big
who's doing the creating, and also, what are they using as a basis for it? Mm. So, for example, I was going to go to a festival about 5 years ago, and so I briefly looked at tents. And after that, for about 3 years, I was followed around the internet by tent advertising. Yeah. I mean, and actually, had they known anything about me, they'd know that it was just an idle thought. I hadn't really been camping.
You hadn't even pulled the trigger on the purchase.
And so, and actually, they were completely barking up the wrong tree. I'm not an outdoorsy person at all. I didn't go to the festival. I didn't go camping. So it wasn't a worthwhile thing to do. Now, my feeling is that probably when it comes to personalized news, it'll be sucking up similar information that it's got from you, these bits and bobs. And I think something that you lose, almost straight away with that, which is very sad, is serendipity.
Yes.
This lovely thing that you could pick something up, a publication, and find a story that you didn't know you wanted, to know about, and which nonetheless is revelatory to you, that changes your perspective on the world, opens up a whole new vista to you. And I think that, and I'm sure that they're all, because the people who work on the algorithms which govern the way that we
they'll introduce a serendipity tweak in the algorithm.
Yeah, they will. There'll be a serendipity button.
But will that be the same as genuine serendipity?
I don't know. I mean, they're terribly sort of clever at this sort of thing.
But you could never really deliver that kind of serendipitous experience of reading a newspaper or magazine online, can you? Because you're always working on such a small piece of real estate. You think of opening up a traditional newspaper and you're reading the bottom left corner.
Yeah.
You could be 2 feet away almost from the top right and spot something you'd never imagine you would be interested in reading. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen on an iPad mini.
It's not, no. And of course, the other thing is that when you're online, there are a million and one other things tugging you one way and the other. So, you're constantly getting updates. You've got a new email. If you start reading halfway down a column, you're directed to a video or an advertiser catches your attention and so on. I mean, one of the lovely things about that old format is it's a self-contained unit. Mm-hmm. So actually, you start to get engaged with it. And the editor can be relatively sure that they might be able to kind of guide you through and pull your attention in various different places and still keep you within this one publication. Whereas actually online, the experience is generally skip, move, skim, skip, move, skim, and, you know, and repeat ad infinitum.
And also read shorter pieces.
Yes.
People are less inclined to read long form on screen, aren't they?
They are, although that has changed a bit recently. And I was really interested in that. So when we started the magazine 5 years ago, that was one of my big things, is just saying, well, you know, nobody does long form online, and long form is wonderful, and, you know, you're much better off in this environment and so on. And actually, I think part of the problem was just one of design. That actually what you had when people did try long form online was you just ended up with this tiny column of text and went on and on and on with white spaces either side. And of course now, you know, anybody with WordPress can do a beautifully styled up thing which has pull quotes, which has, you know, beautiful text, audio and visual built in and so on. So I think, you know, people can and do read on long form online, and I think that will increase. But I do also think that there's something particularly nice about it in print publication as part of a curated mix of other features.
Well, that's what I wonder. Is that how you see the future, and is that how you would like the future to be a more complex ecosystem? So you've got the slow journalism in the form of something that's a physical object like Delayed Gratification Quarterly, but alongside that you have the fast journalism, which is the shoot from the hip, the unmediated, the unfiltered, the get everywhere in the world instantly. Is that how you see it?
I think that's how it's going. I do. I think it will be a big problem for some really, really long established news brands that aren't supported by a trust or that aren't supported like the BBC, you know, through a license fee, of how they make money from providing that sort of shoot from the hip, you know, immediate news coverage. Because I don't see people really paying for that. You know, already I can see that if I've got, you know, my smartphone and my instant updates from, you know, from the likes of the BBC and the Guardian and so on, that it feels a bit redundant to buy a morning newspaper, printed morning newspaper every day. That doesn't seem to make sense. I do, though, I mean, you know, happily from our point of view, I do see there being that really nice space that provides a contrast and a different experience that forces people to take a screen break, you know, and to consider the news in a bit more depth and with a bit more context. And, you know, and that sees the merit also in leaving a bit of time to elapse so that cooler heads can prevail and that, you know, you're not getting the instant knee-jerk reaction on things. But I do think there's going to be a big problem for those, you know, those people who are providing that, you know, daily, you know, hourly, minute-by-minute update of how they make money out of that.
Not least because so many people are doing it, I suppose.
Well, yes, absolutely.
And not that hard to do.
And you know, the citizen journalism thing is fascinating because in principle, it sounds absolutely brilliant because there's 7 billion potential, you know, citizen journalists on the planet. The chances are that one of them is going to be closer to any given story than a journalist from an established news brand. And, you know, when they can...
A breaking story, exactly.
Yeah. And when they can hold up their smartphone and beam that footage in real time to everybody around the planet, and that can be curated and sent to you if that's of interest to you, then that's extraordinary. That's, you know, that's absolutely amazing. And that's very, very powerful. However, it's hard to know how you then carve out a niche if you want to be, you know, a provider of that sort of news. Are you just somebody who verifies, you know, who follows along in the wake of stories that are breaking online and, you know, tries to bring some rigor to it and, you know, check a few things? It seems to me that that's probably the main thing that you can do, except, you know, you can get a report on the scene afterwards and you can hope that maybe people do this two-stage thing of, you know, looking online, you know, and seeing how it unfolds and then going and checking in with your brand. But it's going to be very difficult as more and more people get connected, you know, and as these, you know, programs that people will use for, you know, for filtering what's on, you know, on Twitter and so on become more sophisticated.
I know it's a crude dichotomy to draw, but we're talking slow journalism and then I guess fast journalism, which is the mainstream media. What do you see that is good in the fast end of that equation now?
Yeah, we could not exist without fast journalism. Of course, we couldn't. We're a very small team of people producing a quarterly magazine. And I think it's always really important for me, you know, to emphasize that we are not the solution to anything. We are a counterpoint, you know, a small antidote to the prevailing setup. And of course, you know, we take our cue from what has been in the news already. That's our starting point, is looking at these things. We also try to find stories that haven't been touched by the media at all. But a lot of what we do is going back to those huge stories that were defined by the media at the time as huge stories and just seeing if anything has changed and kind of giving a follow-up.
Or if they were even stories in the first place.
If they were even stories in the first place, exactly.
Because that's something that I found, even going back before the internet age, as a foreign correspondent, the first port of call for you is often to look at the local media or media, it could be the British media as well,
yeah.
and pick a story.
Yeah.
And this, so often I would start scratching at the surface and find that there was no story there. That things had been made up or distorted or somebody on a tight deadline with an impatient boss had just rammed it through.
Exactly.
And it was a dead end.
Exactly. That's quite a worry as well, isn't it? That
deeply
that becomes,
worrying.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that becomes history. That's, yeah. Yeah, that's set in
that's stone. The first draft of history.
A credible title. Mm. Yeah, you know, we can't exist without the fast media. We are a reaction against the fast media. And of course, the fast media is absolutely stuffed with very dedicated, very talented journalists who go into oftentimes unpleasant situations and find, you know, and find something hopefully that has truth and merit that they can report. And of course, there's a huge number of people that I respect absolutely massively who are doing that sort of thing. And as I said, I am as addicted to the instant update as anybody else. That doesn't mean, though, that there aren't huge flaws with that system and that a lot of the stuff that's produced isn't flim-flam and nonsense. You know, I think there's both of those things are in there. But if you're looking for merits, yes, there's lots of talented people working very hard. And of course, you know, when you have a story, you know, like the election, you know, for example, that was great to see in real time. Now, there was a lot of nonsense as well. There was a lot of speculation and, you know, lots of politicians.
The British election here.
Yeah, the British election, yeah. You know, lots of journalists who were unable to get anything out of politicians because they were playing their cards close to their chest, and there were a lot of mad graphics that didn't really add to your understanding at all. But that said, you know, as somebody who was fascinated by the election, it was amazing to be able to stay up and watch, you know, the results come in. So it's, you know, it's a love-hate relationship, I think, that we have with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just trying to provide something, I suppose, additional and perhaps a bit deeper.
Let's rewind to the beginning of Slow Journalism, Delayed Gratification Quarterly. Did you have a personal aha moment when you suddenly thought, I cannot carry on in this all fast mode? Or did you stumble across a particularly egregious example of fast journalism getting it wrong? What was the spark? Where did it start for you?
I think for me, the moment came at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was working on a magazine that my former company were producing for a property company. And I was working on a page about toasters. And it was the 5 best toasters. And I had come up with a headline that I was very pleased with, which was Griller Warfare. Griller spelled G-R-I-L-L-E-R. So that was good. And I had already been told which of the toasters had to win because it was a toaster from an advertiser. And I found myself researching for other toasters online and trying to find something to write about them, looking at the Amazon reviews and so on, and writing stuff like, you know, this 4-slot beauty, you know, can you know, grill up anything that you throw at it, from, you know, bagels to hot cross buns. And just writing this and just thinking, this is absolutely pointless. This is a totally worthless way to spend a life. You know, why on earth am I just producing this content, this matter, that is going to be used to sort of sandwich in between adverts and so on. So that was really my starting point for thinking that I wanted to do something that was a bit better, that, you know, that had some sort of tangible benefit to it, and that actually people were going to rejoice when they got it, rather than just kind of flicking through and then using one of the pages, yeah, tearing it out, using it for their chewing gum. And I think a huge number of journalists are engaged in producing sort of ephemeral, sort of nonsensical, very commercially driven stuff, and it's very dispiriting because a lot of them are very smart characters. So that for me was a turning point, and that wasn't, you know, that was really basically I want to launch a publication that I think kind of really, really sort of matters. And then there were various things that happened along the way that pointed us in the direction, you know, made us feel that we were heading in the right direction in terms of the, you know, the philosophy behind the magazine. I mean, just early when we started work on it, people started being able to tweet from courtrooms, and that felt unsettling and sort of unusual. And then there were these revelations about news agencies having cameras posted on the walls opposite Nelson Mandela's house, so that when he died in the future, they could have cameras on the scene so they could catch the body coming out and so on. And all of these things that just start making you feel a little bit unsettled. A couple of examples of people writing preemptive news stories and getting caught out, and then doing that because, you know, because they were so desperate to be able to be first to the news.
That they'd written it before it
happened. And made up quotes and made up description and so on.
Is there an example that jumps out?
So, I mean, I think the big example is the Amanda Knox retrial. When several publications had prepared, stories for both eventualities for whether the verdict was upheld or overturned. And one of them, the Mail Online, had written this, several hundred word long piece, which included made up quotes and made up description. And they got it ready, and something had happened, and given people in the courtroom the impression that Knox had been found guilty, and actually the verdict had been overturned. But this story that was completely wrong and had made up quotes and description went up online for a couple of minutes before it was pulled back down. So all of those things...
became the standard for other people
For a couple of minutes. And actually, if you look at the original page, you can see that even in those couple of minutes that was left up there, it already got, I think, 66 likes on Facebook. So it started spreading around the world already, So I think all of those different things made us feel that this was something important, at some level, and something that we felt strongly about, I think.
What are the stories that you're most proud of having done so far?
I think my number one story that I'm most proud of is one in our latest issue, and it's about the 43 disappeared Mexican students. It was a huge story in October of last year. So the students were abducted, and the government of Mexico says that they were then killed and their bodies burned. Now, the parents of the students don't believe that and never have. So it was covered. I mean, it was such a... there's always horrible stories coming out
of
Mexico.
But that's a particularly extraordinary story.
It was an absolutely extraordinary story. Yes, exactly.
43 students had just vanished.
Yeah. Exactly. Almost literally without a trace. And so it was a huge story in the international media, in October and a little bit in November last year. And then it was dropped. I mean, understandably, it had as much play as a story about Mexican students is going to have. Obviously, it wasn't dropped in Mexico. It remained a big ongoing story. And so we sent the Mexican journalist back to Iguala, to the place where they were abducted. He spent several weeks with the families of the students. He went on demos with them. He was with them as they petitioned the government. He's with them as they went out searching shallow graves in a particular area, digging up bodies to try to find their children. Just extraordinary, dedicated, intelligent journalist. And he brought this amazing story back, which nobody else got, because nobody else was revisiting it. And it's all about Mexican society and culture. It's about Mexican politics. It's about how the police have become so inured to this sort of thing that when they dig up bodies that aren't of any of the 43 students, and this happens constantly, the police aren't going to investigate it because it's just
one more case to add to the file.
Exactly. Yeah. There's whole hills that are effectively sort of mass graves. So that sort of story I'm really proud of. We did another one.
That story then picked up and echoed in the mainstream, let's call it fast media? I mean, the big papers, the Fleet Street papers in Britain?
No, I've not seen it really particularly. I mean, you occasionally get additional things being mentioned. And, of course, the Mexican president came over on a state visit. And there was a few ripples of interest and so on. But, no, I don't think that was particularly picked up. I mean, that said, we are a kind of a niche publication.
Can I ask you what the circulation is?
Absolutely. So we are selling, on a good issue, selling about 7,000 copies of the magazine, about half of which is subscriptions and the rest is newsstand. So it's modest. Modest, but it is enough for us to do what we want to do, and it's growing very rapidly, which is very nice. Huge growth from small to slightly less small. But
when I hear you describing the work that Mexican journalist put into that story, I just feel myself buzzing with a kind of envy, professional envy, because that's the sort of journalism that I love to do, and I think all journalists aspire to do that. Yeah. Do you have good writers and journalists beating down your door saying, let me in, let me do this?
We have a lot of people approaching us the whole time. We're very lucky insofar as actually the five people who set this magazine up back in 2011 were all journalists. So actually we had a really kind of a nice, strong bedrock of talent to draw on. I mean, sadly, none of us were subscriptions or marketing experts, knew anything about kind of accounting or VAT returns, or distribution, or almost any of the nuts and bolts you would need to make a successful magazine company. But yes, so we had this we have this bedrock of good people. We have a really good network of freelance journalists that we call on. And yes, we're lucky that we get a lot of pitches as well from people. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what's better as a journalist than being told, take 3 weeks, find out, go and get
right
to grips with it.
Story,
exactly.
Yeah.
And don't go to it with any preconceptions. Mm-hmm. I'm not telling you the piece that I need. I just want you to find out and kind of report back. Now, of course, the thing about that is that sort of journalism is very expensive. So I would say we have kind of one or two really solid pieces like that in every issue. And then we have a lot of other kind of, nice pieces in there. But, there's always those one or two real standout pieces. And I hope that, as we grow, there'll be 5 and 10 of those sorts of, mm-hmm. those kind of caliber of stories, I think.
And, well, we've talked about the writers. Who are the readers?
We know relatively little about our readers because we've never sold adverts in the magazine. We've never really kind of pumped them for kind of demographic data. We did a little survey about a year ago. We seem to have, I would say, two distinct clumps of readers. We have people in their kind of 20s and 30s who are interested in media and news and design. And one of the things about the magazine has always been beautifully designed. And then we have people in their 50s and 60s who are much more interested in kind of the philosophy of it, but in the slowing down of it. It's quite funny. We used to take gift messages for gift subscriptions, and there were lots and lots from parents sending it to their kids who are off to university and saying things like, you never read the newspapers, maybe you'll read this. And then lots of people buying it for people for retirement gifts, saying, now you've got a bit more time, put your feet up and enjoy this. So anecdotally, those are kind of the two groups we have. I think it's a really broad mix, and we have a very nice international makeup. So it's about 70% UK. But then we also have, from all over the place, a surprisingly large number from Scandinavia. I think, there's kind of the design thing echoes with them. But so quite a broad church, I would say.
Scandinavia, well, Norway, at least, being the home of Slow TV.
Yes, this is right. Yes.
Showing, the 7-hour train journey is
on
BBC 4 is on the season.
That's right,
that as well.
Yes.
So you're part of that, a broader media slow culture quake, in a way, aren't you? There's Slow TV, there's all kind of slow technology movement, but in a way you fit into that.
I think so, yeah.
One of the signs of success is when the people you're rebelling against start to take notice and start to copy and even borrow your robes a little bit. Do you see some of that in the mainstream media? I know The Guardian, for instance, has introduced a feature called The Long Read, which clearly fits into that same trend and thinking.
The pendulum always swings back, and I definitely think that after our love affair with digital and super fast and so on, people are absolutely finding merit in long form and investigative pieces and so on. I will not for one second claim any sort of ownership of that, because of course when we talk about slow journalism, what we're really talking about is good journalism. And there's always been tons of that about the place. For hundreds of years, people have been writing in-depth, investigative, long-form stuff and, producing and crafting beautiful magazines and so on. So that's always been there and it kind of ebbs and flows. I mean, if you look at something like The New Yorker, they've been doing wonderful, in-depth, long-form pieces for probably centuries now.
Some people might even say some of those pieces are a little bit too long.
Yes, that's true.
That might be the subject for another podcast.
Exactly. So, no, I wouldn't claim that for a second. And I think, these trends are very easy for people to spot. Mm. There's so much talk about what digital and what speed is doing to us. I mean, you did your TED talk in 2005. This is not something that has kind of just kind of come up. And now it's, you're seeing it the whole time. What's it doing to our brains? What's it doing to our society? What's it doing to our kids and so on? So no, I don't think we can claim ownership of that at all. And I do think also in terms of business models, I do think that there is going to be this sort of dichotomy between the kind of super fast immediate news updates, which are going to be very difficult to monetize, and then this counterpoint, these groups of kind of magazines and publications, both online and print, which are going to find ways to make money and stay afloat by selling something that is the opposite of that. And the faster that gets, the greater that market at the other end becomes, I think.
And the way you're making that market work is through a subscription model, isn't it? So you don't have... That was a conscious choice, presumably, not to have advertising of any kind.
That's right, yeah.
And do you feel that not having advertising has freed you up to deepen and pursue the slow mission more?
I think at the beginning, part of it was just a very practical thing. So it's difficult, it's very difficult to sell advertising when you're only selling, you know, 500 copies of a magazine. You'd actually have to be mad to advertise against that. It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, we've grown and evolved, and now we're selling a lot more than that. And actually, you know, you can make a credible case for selling advertising. And it's not something that I can hand on heart rule out, because the economics of making a print magazine, particularly when it's investing so much in the journalism, are very difficult, you know, to square away. It's not a straightforward thing. Part of it has been, you know, I guess to a certain extent, it being outside of our comfort zone. Because as I said, you know, this was set up by five journalists. So what we've always done, what we've always loved doing, is the stories. And, you know, we have a fantastic art director who's now also one of our shareholders. So, you know, we can make you a beautiful magazine, you know, we can fill it with great stories. But in terms of actually, you know, the skill set for going out and selling ads, that's been, you know, that's not really kind of been there. We also always had this idea, to a certain extent, of the magazine being an experimental magazine. So, you know, when everybody else is making or is trying to make money through selling digital advertising and by getting sheer weights of numbers through, you know, to a site to see free content, we kind of wanted to be the opposite of that, to see whether there was a reader-driven, you know, business model in which you could just make something great and sell it to people for slightly more than it costs to make it. And, you know, and they're just buying editorial. Nobody's trying to sell them anything. Nobody's trying to kind of, you know, like commercialize stuff. Nobody's trying to slip in oblique references to products into, you know, otherwise normal seeming features.
Which toasters, especially.
Toasters. Exactly. Check in 3 issues' time with like the toaster special. First 20 pages. No, so, you know, this is the thing. And I can't hand on or, you know, make a commitment that we're never going to sell adverts in the magazine, because my number one priority is to keep it going, you know, keep making a beautiful magazine for our readers, and also to invest more and more in journalism. That's our number one, you know, priority, I think. So.
I mean, you talk about the physical quality of it, and I'm holding one of the issues here, and it is a thing of beauty, isn't it? It's very pleasing to the hand, to the eye. Mm. That must be a big part of how, because, of course, the text and the prose is the anchor for what people are coming for, but that's also the physical side, and especially in a world where more and more things are virtual and digital and ephemeral in that sort of way. I guess that's another USP, isn't it, for you?
I think it's been a huge amount of any success that we've had is the fact that it's just such a lovely and pleasing thing. You know, and right from the beginning, we really wanted that kind of that paper stock that was making the most of what print could be. And part of that was a reaction. So, you know, when we launched, a lot of people were saying print is dead. A lot of big, well-established titles were trying to save money on production costs. They were trying to almost become more like the internet, so more ephemeral, more, you know, more throwaway, bigger pictures, fewer words, you know, all that sort of thing. So it was a reaction against that as well, saying, no, print, there's absolutely a place for print, but it's got to be the best that print can do. It's got to be all of those kind of lovely things. And I think, you know, we certainly wouldn't have had the successes we've had, such as it is, without it looking, you know, like $1 million. Because, you know, people are overwhelmed with choice, you know, the newsstand and in life. There's a million and one things they can spend their money on. So really just kind of grabbing them and giving them every single reason to form a relationship with our magazine is important.
When you look around, do you see other publications?
In the last 5 years, there's been this explosion in independent magazines. You know, this people talk about a renaissance, a new golden age of independent magazines and so on. I have been very surprised that there's been so few launches in current affairs, in news. You know, there's been gigantic numbers of new travel magazines, lifestyle magazines, food and fashion and art, and even philosophy, there's been lots of those. But I'd struggle to mention any, I think, in the last 5 years, any new ones
apart from
the UK.
From the UK.
Makeshift magazine is a fantastic magazine.
Makeshift,
that's kind Where of that news-based. Based. Now, I want to say Canada. It's North America, definitely. But those guys do a fantastic
Similar
job.
Ethos. That's brilliant.
Similar ethos, you know, beautiful production values. Not so much long form. You know, it tends to be kind of shorter, bittier pieces.
But they've taken a longer view.
Great wealth of content. And the stories they get are just absolutely sensational. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely kind of sort of amazing. There's a magazine in Australia called Future Perfect, which is doing some really interesting stuff. They just launched recently. They're kind of looking at news and colours magazine, but they predated us by quite a long time. And they're not part of this new rash of indie magazines, but my goodness, that is a sensational magazine.
And they're also in the news cycle.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, what they do is they do, it's theme by theme, but it's pulling together stories from that most recent period. And they do such a great job. Beautiful kind of production values, amazing little quirky bits. You have these lift off photos that have infographics underneath and so on. And the amount of time and energy they lavish on it.
I would say that in the last 18 months, I've heard from probably four or five student journalists or recently graduated journalists in this country and in other countries who are trying to pull together magazines very like this, actually. And some of them mentioned delayed quarterly, they know delayed gratification, they know all these other ones. And so they're right down there at the very grassroots, the next generation sprouting up.
Yeah.
It's on their radar. They're coming out even before they get into those very fast news. They're already starting to feel that something's missing. There might be a different way of doing things. So that seems to be quite hopeful.
I agree with you, and I'm always astonished. So I do a fair amount of talking at universities. I go to different places, and particularly talking to people who are doing magazine journalism. And what's really interesting to me is that all of them want to launch print publications. Their tutors are telling them you've got to launch a blog or a zine or a site or something like that. And actually, that's not what they want. They want that print publication. They want that thing in their hand, And I find that very kind of positive. Now, when you flip that on its head and you say to them, and how many of you buy, a printed newspaper daily or whatever, actually, goes right there. But it's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting to me that residual, it's not residual, there's that strong interest there among a generation that is, digital native and, has all of these kind of different options and for whom it would be the simplest thing in the world to set up a kind of a new site. Actually, they want that printed thing.
Well, it does, I think, give the lie to this notion, which is constantly being hurled at us, that the millennials simply have no patience. They won't wait for anything.
Yeah.
But actually, if you give them something really good, they will wait for it. So you'll see them queuing up for I don't know how many minutes to get a craft artisan a coffee from a barista, right?
Yeah.
Or one of the biggest success stories in the kind of fast food chain industry in the U.S. is Chipotle, right?
Yes.
Where you queue, someone makes something for you. It's not the burger that's been prefabricated before you arrived, in a furnace behind.
Yeah.
So it's about kind of how you frame things, and it's also about giving them the things that you're talking about, I think. The quality, the perspective, the merit.
Yes.
Something that let's use the food metaphor, something that actually nourishes.
Yes.
Right?
And
give them that. They still have 24 hours in the day, right? That hasn't changed.
Exactly,
how you use them. And if you give people, it seems to me, that they want to spend their time, well, they will. They will invest that time.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I think that's exactly right. I think, it's very interesting as well, this huge resurgence in vinyl.
Yes, that's another very good example.
These people, and I totally see it as well, because if you're kind of, going on a run or whatever, then Spotify, yes, or, your iTunes, yes. But actually, when you're kind of settling down at home with a glass of wine, maybe lighting the fire, and just that action of, actually every element of it, taking it out of the sleeve, the cover art, pop it on.
It's the ritual.
And the crackle when you put it down. I don't know. Yeah. And people are into that. Now, they've also got, their Spotify and so on. And actually, that's probably what they use for 80% of their music. But there's also this interest on the other side.
Well, maybe there's the same metaphor if we apply to journalism. You've got the fast journalism, but they also want to have the whatever the percentage is going to be.
Yep.
They're going to want the stuff that you're delivering and other people like you, the slow journalism as well.
Yes, hopefully so.
And these are things, vinyl's a very good example, because that really had been, the obituaries were written for that at least 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
All is not lost, I suppose, when it comes to
seeing
the virus of hurry.
Exactly right,
We are still human at core.
Yeah.
And there's certain things that we all respond to and
appreciate,
and aspire to and take pleasure from. Yeah. Couple last questions.
Of course, yes.
You talked about this as being an experiment. Mm. And so that means in some ways maybe that moving from the idea of slow to the practice. Mm. I'm wondering how that's evolved with the magazine, the most recent issue versus the first one. Mm. Is there a different feel? Have you made mistakes along the way that you've had to correct?
We made a lot of mistakes along the way. And actually, if I look back, I was terribly proud of the first few issues. But we hadn't really kind of nailed down at that stage, what really kind of made the perfect. There were a few fantastic pieces, I think, that really sort of stood the test of time. But I don't think we quite nailed down what we were for and how we were going to deliver it. And actually, there were some very foolish kind of practical mistakes that we made. So in our desire to ram this magazine as full as possible of, you know, of content. We took the point size down to, I think, about 7. And actually, you know, quite a lot of people got in touch after the first issue and said, look, I think it's a good magazine. I don't know, because I can't read it. So that was an error. We have been caught out a couple of times with stories that have, you know, where 3 months wasn't long enough to leave it.
Oh, right. So you went you were too fast?
Then? We were too fast, yeah, yeah. So we got caught out on a story about Jimmy Savile in particular.
Oh, well, you weren't alone in getting caught out on that story.
No, exactly. So, we, you know, we had this...
I should explain, he's the paedophile in chief for listeners who are
that's right. in the UK. Yes, exactly. Well, so, I mean, yeah, so he died, and then we had an issue come out, and we thought, what's the most interesting thing about Jimmy Savile? We did some research, and he was such a sort of kind of a big character in the UK. And we wrote this. We ended up commissioning this story about the fact that early in his career he was a pro cyclist. So the you know the Stamfirst went something like, Jimmy Savile, you know, DJ and philanthropist, but there was another side to him. He was also a pro cyclist. I mean, it's obviously you know. And then about you know a month or so after the issue came out, it became very apparent that he was one of the worst, you know, sexual offenders that the country has ever known. Mm-hmm. So that we got caught out there. Happily, those sort of things are.
That's interesting, though, because how do you decide when it's time to pull the trigger on a story? You talk about the 3 months as a, but when do you say this story's over? We're going to tie the bow on it and bring it all around full circle. How does one know? Because some of these things are. I mean, you're talking about say Ebola
yes,
in
yeah,
Africa
yeah.
or the Syrian crisis. At yeah. what point do you step into the, mm-hmm. the fray?
Mm-hmm. I think it's at the point where we've got something new to say, something new and substantive to say. So you're absolutely right. There are some stories that are just kind of trickling along in the background, and you know it's not useful, or that are you know, very much still happening when our new issue comes out. So we do try to visit stories that have you know have at some point either come to an end or have dropped out of the media coverage. And sometimes it's fine to have an update and then to kind of revisit it again. I mean, obviously we've run many stories on what's been happening in Syria over the last few years. Each time we try to find a new perspective, each time we try to find something that we're bringing that the mainstream media isn't. But we wouldn't for a second suggest that, you know, that the situation isn't still unfolding. Quite often also, it can be quite interesting just to take a 3-month slice of something. So for example, with what has been happening in Ukraine, actually what we did was we took the first 3 months of that, you know, covering the invasion of Crimea and covering the sort of the you know, Maidan Square and covering what was happening in the east of the country. And actually, sometimes there's something really nice about just taking a 3-month chunk, looking back at it, and realizing how the story evolved. Ukraine was a fascinating case in point because, you know, it started as a very small, localized series of protests, and then it spiraled in, and we actually did a timeline of the first 3 months just to show how, you know, as this period progressed, other countries were sucked into it, and it suddenly became this massive global thing. And sometimes also you can forget the origins of stories, or you can miss out on them, and suddenly you know you're trying to keep on top of what's going on, and because you weren't following it properly at the beginning, that can be quite difficult. So I think there's multiple different ways that we take a call on whether something is you know something that we would cover or not.
Mm-hmm. I slightly broke in on you there. I think you were going through a list of changes that have made in the way you do things?
So I think, you know, we got a bigger point size. We're much more wary about commissioning pieces about dead celebrities. and you know, we just got a bit better. So we're commissioning more ambitious stories. That said, in our very first issue, we had one of our best stories ever, which was about the English Defence League. So we had a journalist, one of our very best journalists, spent several weeks with the English Defence League.
Which is a political movement, right?
That's right, yeah. And before they had really kind of entered the national consciousness that much. The English Defence League is a fascinating organisation. It's got multiple different divisions. And so it's often lumped in with the BNP, the British National Party, the Nationalist Party.
We're talking about nationalist right-wing parties
exactly.
here.
Exactly, yes, yeah. But actually, it's got multiple different divisions, including it's got a Jewish division. So our reporter actually spent several weeks with the Jewish division of the English Defence League, and he was there on November the 11th, 2010, Remembrance Day 2010, when the group called Muslims Against the Crusades was burning poppies, and the English Defence League was counter-protesting against them. And he turned in this wonderful, you know, 3,500-word story really kind of getting to grips with the
people. I read that piece, actually.
Their motivations, yeah. Where they were coming from, what they were trying to do. It just kind of turned into a great piece. So actually, we were doing good stuff. I just think that, our hit rate has gone up. And we've got a bit smarter about how we position things and, what we do in terms of infographics and stuff like that. But actually, the core of it has, I think, mm-hmm. remained the same over the 5 years.
Looking into the future, crystal ball moment, where do you hope to be in a couple of years' time?
Well, so our main thing is more of the same. So just, continuing to invest, like getting that subscription money and plowing it into better journalism, more ambitious journalism, and really providing a home for journalists to write the sort of stories that they very rarely get to these days. So I think that's the side of things. We're also really trying to give more back to our subscribers. So we're starting to run subscriber events. We're doing classes where we teach people for free how to make delayed gratification style infographics. We're doing a series of events at the V&A Museum. We're doing slow journalism nights at the V&A Museum.
Are you?
So it's fun. So we've done three already. And what happens is subscribers come down and they get to hear some of our journalists talking about stories that they've been working on. Photojournalists presenting beautiful photos. Sometimes we have a little news quiz. So it's just quite a nice thing to do once every quarter to come down and to think about stories that have been off the news agenda for quite a while.
And that's the Victoria and Albert Museum in London,
of course.
Yeah. That's something I see other publications doing as well, allowing people to peek behind the curtain, talk to the journalists. Get an experience of what it was like to take the photos and that kind of thing.
I think
they want to be participatory. It seems to be the kind of cultural trend. They want to be able to comment.
Yes.
They don't just want to be served the final product.
Exactly right. And I think what that comes back to as well is this real communities. So I think real communities, as opposed to virtual online communities, have some. And I think for a long time it was all about just getting your Facebook likes up and getting your Twitter following up and so on. And what that actually converts into is very hard to define. What does that mean?
It's
if
just
I get a like of users, it's just a nonsense. Whereas actually, I'd much rather have 30 people in a room talking with them, getting their thoughts, sharing a beer with them. It's a really fascinating experience.
Does it become a two-way street? Do the readers feedback to you ideas that or stories that they would love you to follow up or
absolutely they do and they don't pull any punches as well, which is good. it's not always good for the ego, but it's a fantastic thing to kind of sit and talk with somebody and talk through the different motivations. So I'm very much in favor of that. I think more of that community building, more of spending time with subscribers and getting to know them a bit better is definitely on the radar. Potentially we are looking at doing some licensed versions of the magazine. Maybe in different languages in different countries through other publishing companies, that could be interesting. But fundamentally, more of the same. Maybe there'll be a podcast, maybe there'll be some documentaries. But I think at the heart of it all is going to be this printed quarterly publication that we're just going to make better and better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're probably getting to the end here. I want to say an enormous and enthusiastic thank you. I mean, I've always admired what you've been doing. It's great to sit in the room with you and hear it. And as I say, as a journalist, I just think journalism is such a central part of what makes a society tick and helps us be better versions of ourselves. And we've lost our way, I think, journalistically over the last 10 years. And I think it's publications like you and your team who are yanking us back to something a bit more.
Thank you very much. It was real pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's been great. Just a final thought.
Of course.
I want everybody who's listening to go out and subscribe to the...
Thank you.
So tell them how they can do it.
Please do. Yes, wonderful. So just go to slow-journalism.com. That's our site. Click on subscribe. And if you use the promo code SLOWNEWSDAY, that's all one word, SLOWNEWSDAY, then you'll get a 10% discount on a subscription.
Magnificent. That's my favorite kind of day, is slow news day.
Yeah, slow news day, exactly.
Perfect point to end. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thanks so much.